Welcome to episode 157 of the Sentientism Podcast, a podcast about what's real and what matters. The Sentientism worldview answers those two deep questions by committing to using evidence and reason and having compassion for all sentient beings. In this episode, I speak with Anita Kreinch and Nicola Harris. Anita is Executive Director of the Plant-Based Treaty Initiative and the Animal Save Movement. She describes herself as an animal rights and an environmental activist. She's the co-author of the book, The Secret Lives of Pigs. Nicola is Director of Communications for the Plant-Based Treaty Initiative and works on the Animal Save Movement's communications team. She has over 20 years of experience in pressure campaigning in the UK. I'd love to know what you think of this episode and the 156 others. Why not let me know via a review, rating or comment? Check out our back catalogue too if you've just found us. Hopefully these conversations are pretty timeless. Every person who subscribes, likes, rates, reviews or shares an episode with a friend helps to nudge the world towards more compassionate, rational thinking. You can find out more about sentientism at sentientism.info, where you can sign up for email updates. I hope you like the new website. Or just search for sentientism on your favourite social media platform. You'll be made very welcome in all of our global online communities. They're open to anyone interested, not just sentientists. Our biggest is on Facebook, which now has over 2,000 members from around 100 countries. Thanks for listening. Good morning, Anita, and good afternoon, Nicola. How are you two?
We're doing great.
Yeah, really good, thank you.
Great. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to join this series of sentientist conversations. I think this is going to be fun because it's the first time I've tried to interview two people at once, so I'm not sure how I'll do, but it's going to be interesting to compare and contrast your philosophical journeys and how you think about how we can make a better future. And as we've discussed briefly before, this is a series of conversations about what I think of as the two deepest philosophical questions, the question of what's real and how should we choose what to believe, but as importantly, the questions of ethics and what matters and who matters and who warrants our compassion. And in that context, of course, how do we try and make a better world? And I have an obvious bias because I'm trying to popularize and develop this really simple pluralistic worldview called sentientism, which suggests that we should commit to using evidence and reason when thinking about how to understand reality. And when it comes to the questions of ethics, we should have compassion for all sentient beings. But I'm talking in these conversations to people, whether they agree or disagree with that worldview. So it'll be fascinating to understand your own personal journeys. But before we get on to those big questions, how would you best introduce yourselves? And Anita, do you want to kick us off?
Hi, I'm with Plant-Based Treaty, and I'm the executive director of Animal Save Movement, and we bear witness to animals in front of slaughterhouses. And so I would describe myself as an animal rights activist as well as an environmentalist.
Wonderful. Thank you. Nicola.
Hi, I'm Nicola Harris. I'm from the UK. I'm part of the communications team for Animal Save Movement and Plant-Based Treaty. I've been a vegan activist for over 20 years and have a long history of pressure campaigning. But right now my main focus is Plant-Based Treaty, which I absolutely love and, you know, want everyone to get behind it.
Yeah, it's a wonderful example of activism that we'll return to when we're thinking about how to make a better future. And I was particularly excited to see my old hometown of Norwich as the latest city to sign up with a PBT. So that was a great timing. Well, let's start with the first of these really big philosophical questions, the questions of what's real and how do we go about believing. And for many of my guests, it's a story about whether they grew up originally in maybe a more religious or spiritual or supernaturally minded household and society, or one that was maybe more scientifically minded and more naturalistic in the way that they thought, and how that side of their thinking has changed over time, if it has. So you can wind the clock back as far as you're comfortable to sort of tell the story about how you grew up thinking about this sort of epistemological question and where you are now. But Nicola, do you want to start telling us your story on that front?
Yeah, sure. So I wasn't raised to follow any religion or faith. So when I think about it, I guess perhaps I was raised more as an atheist upbringing. I don't think we ever really had conversations about religion or beliefs or anything like that. But I do feel that with my upbringing, I was still raised with strong values and morals. I was raised to be open-minded and critical and follow my heart and dreams. And I always sort of had this belief instilled from my mother that I could achieve anything that I wanted. And you know, she supported everything that I do. So I was never set down on a path of this is how you should be or this is what you should do. I was sort of just encouraged, I think, to find my own way. And I think, I guess the way I view the world has changed throughout life, which I think, you know, we all have, like, especially as a vegan, you know, I wasn't born vegan, but my journey to veganism has led me to question everything, question reality, because, you know, I was born and to eat animals. And I think one of my very first memories, I'm not sure how old I was, but I was very, very young. I was sat in a car looking out the window, and I remember seeing some fields, and I saw some Highland cows, and I'd never seen one before. And they were so beautiful with their like red shaggy hair and their big horns. And I was like, I was mesmerized. I said to my mum, like, you know, what's that? Like, this is amazing. And she told me it was a Highland cow. But then she said, oh, you know, it's beef. And I was just like, what? And this is when you start questioning reality. Because I was so like, what? And, you know, that was the first time that I understood that the food on my plate was the flesh of an animal. I was horrified. And I guess at that time, my parents saw a reaction in me that kind of worried them, because then they were like, trying to like, oh, you know, it's okay. And, you know, they told me that, you know, oh, you have to eat it, otherwise you'll die. And like, they told me that not to worry, because, you know, we only eat the animals when they die of old age. And so there's no harm done. And, you know, I was sort of uncomfortable with it. But as a very young child, you accept what you're told by your parents, that you must eat it, I'm going to die. The animals die of old age, they live these happy lives. And so I just accepted it at that time. But I was always uncomfortable with it, because from that point, I became a very fussy, picky eater that still made me very uncomfortable. But a few years later, as I'm getting older, I'm learning more about questioning things. And I did become a vegetarian, and that I still had a bit of ick around dairy. I've never eaten cheese or anything like that. And then I think, you know, when I became vegan, that, like, it changes everything, because then I realized that, I guess, we all, I guess, go through some sort of, I don't know if I want to call it brainwashing, but we're brought up with certain values, and then something breaks and you question it. And I think when I became vegan, that made me kind of question and look at everything in life, because, you know, that everything you've been taught is wrong. And then I think as well, like, when I was a teenager, I really got into like punk rock and hardcore and DIY. So I was really into my music, and I played in bands, and that made me more political as well. And that, I guess, taught me to question things, because, you know, you can't go to like a punk gig without coming home with some pamphlets about stopping wars or the environment or animal rights. And through that, you sort of meet different people, and you like learn from each other, and you sort of build this community.
What do you think of the Moby film?
Oh yeah, I know, I loved it. I absolutely loved it.
Yeah, and I had my eyes open to the role of punk in animal advocacy by some previous guests, you know, Christoph Domp was one, and the sociologist Nick Pendergrass was another. And I was like, I had no idea it was such an activist movement in so many different directions, particularly around the animal advocacy space. But in your answer there, which is fascinating, you've already demonstrated how hard it is to separate these questions about what's real and who matters, because I think they do become deeply intertwined. And as you said, you know, you grew up with a sort of non-religious, broadly atheistic background, but the societal views about animal agriculture weren't just telling you not to care. It wasn't an ethical thing. It was actually warping the facts and warping reality to try and justify something that was causing harm. So that's part of the interplay I find absolutely fascinating, is how, you know, there can be ethical problems, but they're also just getting the facts wrong and deliberately warping the facts. And these two things can combine together. So you grew up without a religious background, to, you know, a sort of assumed but almost unstated atheism. And for many people, and you talked about trying to use evidence and reasoning to try and work out what's true as a sort of general approach. Is that something you sort of stick with now? Do you see that that's an important approach? are there other areas of your life where, you know, maybe more spiritual or supernatural things, or things that maybe are beyond the classical natural world, you think might still be out there? Or are you a sort of boring, hard-edged naturalist like me, who's sort of skeptical of all of that stuff?
I don't follow a particular faith or religion. Like, I've often been quite drawn more towards like paganism and like the earth-based religions and things like that, and just like respecting nature. But I think who I am is just very much informed by my experiences and seeing things for myself. And I've tried to do that in my activism as well. Years ago, I used to run a local animal rights group, and part of our vegan advocacy was taking people inside of chicken farms, because I just felt like it's really easy just to tell people, oh, this is bad, don't do this, this is what's happened. But like, you know, I think when you experience it for yourself, you can't deny what you're witnessing. And so that's why we used to take people on like kind of like excursions to, look, I'm going to show you what this is, the reality. Because, you know, I know myself, I've been told many things that aren't true, or these warped realities. And so I just feel like it's really important to get people to experience and feel. And it's similar with, you know, like bearing witness, like meeting the animal, seeing it for yourself, and then using that to like inform who you are.
Yeah, thank you. And we talked before we start a little bit about, you know, I see naturalism as being broader than just science. And that's a perfect example, right? Just our own personal experiences are evidence too. And yeah, of course, we can be skeptical about them. We can be subject to illusions, or we can be, you know, our perceptions can be warped. They're not always accurate. But there's something so powerful about that act of bearing witness, because you are seeing directly the harms that are being done. I mean, it's incontrovertible. There's no real denying that. And that has a radically different impact from, as you say, just reading an article or watching Dominion even, you know, just actually being there in person must be so viscerally directly impactful, because the evidence is flooding your senses moment to moment. And in the same way as you can take a very scientific approach to, you know, assessing the sentience, for example, of a pig or a chicken, and you can think about evolutionary history, or you can think about biological information processing architectures, and you think about behaviors and communications, and you can sort of do all sort of scientific analysis to, you know, determine are these beings sentient or not. Or you can look them in the eye and spend time with them, and, you know, the evidence is right there. So yeah, I think that's a powerful example of how this idea of using evidence isn't just a sort of narrowly scientific testing. It's about, you know, the power of our own personal experiences too. Yeah, thank you. So Anita, how would you answer that same question about your sort of epistemological history and way of thinking now?
When I grew up, I grew up in a Catholic household that was very dogmatic. And so my journey was always trying to rebel against that, not wanting to go to church on Sunday, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
My parents came from the former Yugoslavia. They were very devout Catholics. Unlike Nicola, I didn't really think about animals or eating animals. I didn't think about it. Whereas my sister was, you know, questioning eating chicken and chickens. So it took me till my 20s when I went to the University of Toronto. I saw a poster for the Animals film narrated by Julie Christie. It was the first film that's graphic. Very great film. Anyway, so I
and Anita, do you mind if we come back to the sort of animal question in a bit in the second section? Because I would, if you don't mind me dragging you back, I'd be really interested in your, you know, why as a child did you push back on Catholicism? What was it that was?
It didn't seem very authentic. It was very dogmatic. It was going to the church, like there was just like performance, like the same performance every week. I didn't find it very interesting or convincing, or yeah, I didn't. And early on, when I was a teenager, I discovered Carl Sagan, and that rang with me much, much more. So yeah. I bought all his books. I loved the series Cosmos, and you know, the delight of, you know, thinking there's life all over the universe and it's special. And yeah, so that rang true with me. It was it just seemed very conservative to me to be part of the, you know, the Catholic Church.
Yeah,
growing
and,
up.
And some of my guests are still religious now, but most have, you know, like most people, were brought up in some religious context and then have moved away. And for some of them, it was about the sort of evidence and the reason that this just story didn't seem to make sense to me. It didn't ring true. It didn't seem to fit with my understanding of the world. And for other people, the actual problem was actually more social or ethical, where they saw behaviors or practices that were just like, this rings wrong with me, whether it was, you know, why can't the priests be women, or homophobia, or some other sort of exclusionary ethic? Or was it a bit of both of you, or was it mainly the evidence and reason in this just doesn't feel true?
It was the latter as well.
Yeah.
Being sexist, being, it just, I think it was both those things. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And was it a difficult process moving away from religion? I mean, there's obviously the sort of young and then the teenage rebellion thing, which parents sort of expect, but some of my guests, it's been, you know, like me, it's pretty easy, right? It just sort of faded away, but it wasn't really that important to my family or the society. So it just sort of faded. But for other people at the other extreme, I've spoken to some people who, you know, it was a serious social risk and even a physical risk for them to move away from a religious worldview. How tough did you find it?
My sister and I were sort of forced to go to church.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to go. And it was just arguments and, you know, things like that. But so we ended up going to church when we were, you know, teenagers. But then when I started pushing back at some point, you know, I could gain my independence. And so it wasn't too difficult, but obviously we had very different worldviews from our parents, particularly my mother.
Yeah, makes sense. And that combination of moving away from a religious worldview and the sort of Carl Sagan starts, I really like, because one of the things that Carl Sagan is brilliant at is you don't lose the awe and wonder, right? In fact, I think you have a richer sense of awe and wonder through a naturalistic understanding of the universe. So that's a bit of a classic. But a similar question to the one I asked of Nicola is, you know, the idea of religion looms large. That question of theism, atheism is obviously a big one culturally, but there are so many other things we could choose to decide about. Are there any other areas of your world where you've left some space for something potentially supernatural, spirits, souls, mystical stuff?
Yeah, I sort of like to think that animals have souls, I'm a big follower of Leo Tolstoy, my ideas very much mirror his. And one of the things I like about what he did was he systematically looked at sort of the best ethical concepts in different religions and philosophies, and it's in a book called Calendar of Wisdom. And that's where we got a really nice definition of bearing witness, also a beautiful definition of the golden rule, where he applies to other animals. That's what I liked about it. He sort of looks at these high ethical principles, like the golden rule, treat others as you'd like to be treated. And we all know it applies to animals. If we, you know, listen deeply to our hearts, he says something to that effect. And also love thy neighbor, and those two are combined. Those are very, I sort of believe that they're universal principles, in the sense that if there's life on another planet, they apply. I just find that so interesting, how the universe could be set up that way, you know, with these high ethical principles, if we would just listen. And a lot of the religions have that somewhere. So they have these truths. They have a lot of other things that aren't good, but they have these high ethical principles. Yeah. So for me, life is something very special, and it's hard to explain. Like, it's hard to explain sentience, it's hard to explain cognition, you know, like thinking and just being alive and aware. I don't know what to make of it, you know. I that's my bottom line answer. I don't agree with the dogmatism of, you know, religions. I don't believe in miracles. See, he didn't believe in miracles, he didn't believe in resurrection, the second coming, you know, all that stuff. And he said Jesus was a man. Maybe he was a man, you know, maybe he existed. And so my views are quite similar to those, but there's something very special about life, and, you know, it's just hard to understand.
No, I agree. And I think that acknowledging that some stuff is hard to understand is, for me, a really good hallmark of naturalistic thinking, right? This idea that we have some magical right to know everything perfectly is bizarre, right? We're just sort of stumbling around trying to build partial understanding of you know, the reality we're part of. So that's humility is important to me. And it's interesting how you talk about the idea of a soul, because for some people, they use the term soul. Actually, in a scientific context, it's just like another word for being sentient or being conscious. Whereas for other people, a soul is something that is, you know, explicitly magical, if you like, or distinct from the operations of our brains and our bodies and our nervous systems as well. So there's some interesting flexibility in the way people use different pieces of language. But that's fascinating. So I think all of us are sort of broadly naturalistic in using evidence and reason to ground our thinking, but I'm sure there's plenty of specific things we might disagree on, but I think we probably share that broad view. But let's come on to the second question, which we've touched on already, of what matters and who matters, and maybe we'll carry on with you for a bit, Anita, because this is one area where it can be really interesting as people move from a religious worldview, although it sounds like you never really had one, you were pushing back from quite early on. A religious worldview often comes with a package of ethics. So it comes with things you're supposed to believe and a way of believing, right? Here's the Bible, here's the Quran, there is a God, there's heaven and hell, whatever. So there's a list of facts you're supposed to believe in and have faith in. But it often comes with an ethical system as well. And that might be commandments, it might be hadiths, it might be guidance written down in books. Quite often there's a strong theme of obedience and, you know, frankly, doing what you're told by the deity, you know, sort of divine command theory structure. So for some people, when they move away from a religious worldview, that can be quite tricky because they've got to rebuild something else. And Nicola, we'll come to you in a bit, but it sounds like you never had that issue because, one, you didn't come from a religious starting point and your family had very strong positive ethical values already. But was that ever a challenge for you at all, Anita? Did you feel like something was missing ethically as you sort of moved away from a Catholic worldview? Did you feel like you had to rebuild? And if so, what was the grounding of your ethics?
In the Catholic world that I was brought up, I didn't think there was a strong foundation other than, you know, the Ten Commandments. Maybe there's some good ideas, other good ideas there, but I didn't, it wasn't like being brought up in some other religions. Like Regan Russell is somebody who passed away at one of our vigils, and her parents brought her up in an Anglican worldview that was very strong ethically, like in terms of just helping others. And I didn't grow up in a household where that was a strong tradition of, you know, where we, so I don't think it wasn't difficult to move away from the world that I was living in. You know, going to university, it was, I was right away attracted to peace and conflict studies. I was worried about a nuclear war. I quickly got into environmentalism. once I saw that film, I was quick, you know, I became the president of the University of Toronto Students for Ethical Treatment of Animals. So that it was very easy for me to, it was wonderful sort of being able to join these different social movements that were readily available, you know, once you go to university. So
yeah. And you've talked about, I guess, some of your ethical foundations already, some of the ideas from Tolstoy, the golden rule, this idea of, you know, caring about others and compassion, which to me are almost tautologically the core of what morality is about. You know, what else could it be about? So that comes through really strongly. And you've talked also about this transition to thinking more broadly about who gets to matter, and, you know, that transition of it, realizing it's not just humans. It sounds like that's something you went through quite quickly. You recognized quite naturally and quite directly, and it just changed the course of your life as well. Is there any more you want to share about how you went through that process of recognizing that non-human animals matter and putting that into practice? And again, what was that journey like for you? Was that difficult or easy?
Yeah, sorry. When I first went to university, I was just interested in peace and conflict studies, and I was human centric. And it didn't even occur to me to think about other animals other than, you know, my influence with Carl Sagan and things like that. But when I saw the film, the animals film, it completely changed my worldview. It was so interesting because I was an omnivore, never even thought about it. Like I would like eating cow flesh and pig flesh, anything like before that, like it didn't even occur to me.
Yeah.
And so the film was really important to me. And what was important in the film was also like, it had a feminist aspect. It talked about how the female sows were, you know, impregnated and raped and things like that. It's like a farmer joked about a rape rack, things like that. So like it was so easy for me to move into this new world because I was already concerned about feminism and anti-war and things like that, and life, you know, preserving life from a nuclear war. But once I saw this film, and it just shows you the power of just, you know, learning and going to university, watching films, things like that, it changed my worldview. And then from then on, it became a core value for me. And then I took environmental thought courses, which were amazing. Like, it was just so wonderful. You know, does a tree have standing? You know, does the Grand Canyon matter as a, you know, even, you know, what has standing? You know, like the Grand Canyon is physically, you know, this incredible landscape, and, you know, beyond animals and species and, you know, trees and forests and rivers, like, you know, even the Grand Canyon has standing. And so like, it opened my world, you know, to take philosophy courses. And it was a nice journey.
Yeah. Sounds like it was a proper transformational moment, because that film just connected to some of the themes of your existing thought, and it just all fell into place and where you went from there. Yeah. Thank you. And one of the things that'd be interesting to examine, because it's clear that, you know, your compassion extends definitely to non-human animals. I'm interested in the degree to which you think sentience is a useful thing to zero in on, because, you know, the definition of veganism, for example, uses the term animal. I tend to focus on the term sentience as a slightly more technical way of describing any being that can have experiences, and any being that therefore values itself and cares about itself. And that's where the imperative comes from for us to care about them. So I'm interested in that boundary, but I'm also interested in, given your work on, you know, some of the environmental ethics stuff, is some people will criticize sentientism and veganism and say, look, you're not going far enough because you're only caring about the sentient beings. You're discriminating against the stuff that maybe isn't sentient, you know, plants, fungi, rocks, rivers, trees, ecosystems, the Earth as Gaia, the Grand Canyon. So I'm interested in your view there about this sort of scope of moral consideration. Do you go as far as sentience, or do you actually go beyond that and think that the Grand Canyon warrants moral standing in its own right?
I would definitely go beyond that, because I, in the 90s, I was active with Sephora Berman. She's now with the Fossil Fuel Treaty, our partner, sort of. She was a blockade leader for the Clackwood Sound campaign. So I went to Clackwood Sound. It's on west coast of Vancouver Island, and they have 1,000-year-old trees, and which are humongous. And they're so it's so important to protect these, not just, you know, because they provide a habitat for other animals and species, but in and of themselves. So like, if you went to an old growth forest, you would see how it's spiritual in a more naturalistic way. It's just like, it's very special, and it's just incredible. Nature is incredible. It's such a gift. And I think these trees and these forests have, rights in and of themselves. They're not just a utility to us or animals with sentience. They're in and of themselves important. And so I would 100% think that, you know, sentience is absolutely important. But and it's funny, because if you do the right thing for these other beings, it also allows for us to live, you know, in a you know, quality of life, or also just in terms of survival, like basic survival. And that's what I find so fascinating, is like, because if we destroy the forests, you know, we're going to face an existential threat.
Yeah, thank you. And Nicola, if I can ask a similar question of you, because you already, again, introduced the animal part of your story and how you came to think more broadly about compassion. It sounds like, as you were growing up, your family had, you know, strong sort of ethical value set, but I'm assuming that was quite human-centered. What was the journey you went through to extending that more broadly, and how do you think about that sort of question of moral scope now? How far would you go?
It definitely human-centered upbringing. But, you know, my mum used to take me over to the animal rights stalls on Saturdays when we went out shopping, and we used to sign the petitions against fox hunting and fur. And so, you know, even though I didn't have like a vegan upbringing, I definitely, I guess, had a bit of animal rights.
The seeds were there.
For me. And I think I spent a lot of time out in nature. So like weekends with my family, we'd be out hiking, we'd be in forests, you know, I would be building little dens with my dad. And we used to, we'd build these dens so that we could photograph the deer, and we'd get up really early and photograph them. So I had like a lot of connection with nature and with animals, and you know, and obviously, as we all do, like we recognize the sentience in these animals and feel that they should, you know, have that consideration. But I do, you know, I do believe that extends beyond, like with Anita with trees. I've been reading, I don't know if you've read it, The Hidden Life of Trees. It's been a really popular book, and it's blown my mind, because I've learned about how trees communicate with each other, how they support each other, and they work as a community. They learn from each other, they feel, they like form like alliances, and they work together with the rest of the forest and the fungi and everyone that lives there. They respond to threats. And it really like opens your eyes to like, I guess, a magical world of trees. And then you get this appreciation and love for them, and you know, and you want to protect them just as you want to protect animals. Trees are life. They support life on earth. They are their own community. So I do absolutely extend my moral scope to the environment around us. And, you know, we are all connected. Every choice that we make has a consequence and a global impact. And if you look at lots of the crises we face, like pandemics and the climate crisis, these are all problems that we have in our natural world that have been caused by our harm and exploitation of other animals. So I think we have to look at everything together.
Yeah, and there are so many synergies and, you know, positive and negative cycles that I think just clearly incentivizes us to extend our moral scope more generously. You know, the harm we do to sentient beings damages the environment, and the damage we do to the environment harms sentient beings. So quite often there's a, you know, really rich synergy in our imperative for action, almost regardless of where we draw the boundary. And it's an interesting balance, because it sounds like both of you would go more towards a sort of biocentrism or an ecocentrism of moral consideration directly, much more broadly. I tend to be more strict to my sentiocentrism. Sometimes worry if I'm just over obsessed with the idea of sentience, and that almost all value ultimately seems to come back to me, to, you know, the impact on the experience of a sentient being. And so in a sense, I think we'd still have an enormous overlap in our a rich concern for the environment. But whereas you might have a much more direct technical moral consideration for a tree, regardless of its impact on any other beings, I would care about that tree because of its impact on the sentient beings that live in and around it and rely on the environment that it helps to sustain and so on. So I think there can still be quite a lot of commonality. But I guess what I've tried to suggest that we do with sentientism is that it's much more focused on making sure no sentient being is excluded, and it's not too worried about including non-sentient stuff. that's less of a problem. So in a way, I'm saying, look, let's at least make sure all the sentient beings get serious moral inclusion, and then we can go further if you like, but the most important thing is no sentient being gets excluded. Because I guess I have a frustration that there are two things that people can do. One is they can attribute sentience more broadly than I happen to think, and I think we should be open to understanding sentience in a rich way, and we should vary that too. If we, you know, as we learn more about plants, we may well find out that they are sentient. I don't know. I'm skeptical at the moment, but if they are, that should have moral implications. We should be open-minded to it. We should look on that with clear eyes. So sentientism doesn't say which entities are sentient. It just says use a naturalistic approach to try and work it out and be humble about doing that. So I think there's a generous way of doing that and an open-minded way of doing that. But of course, there's also the, you know, anti-vegan troll on Twitter who loves telling us that plants are sentient, so there's no difference between cutting a carrot and a pig. So, you know, why be vegan? So I think there's a positive, generous way you can think those things through. And there's also a sort of ethically flattening way where you can say, look, in a sense, everything matters. So nothing matters more than anything else. And we have to survive. So, you know, why is sentience relevant anymore? So I think my only suggestion for people who are interested in going into sort of biocentrism or ecocentrism is recognizing, one, that the positive synergies are absolutely there. So we probably agree on loads of stuff anyway. But two, that even if we do think about biocentrism or ecocentrism and grant some degree of moral consideration that richly, that sentience still warrants some special consideration, because ultimately I don't think, you know, a carrot feels pain when you cut it, whereas I'm absolutely sure a chicken does. So I'm still making an appeal for sentience to loom large in our moral consideration, even if we go beyond sentience. But I don't know what you think of that part. And part of my frustration is with the mainstream environmental movement, in a way, which does tend to jump from an anthropocentric stance to a really generous ecocentric stance, but then conveniently excludes consideration for all of the quadrillions of sentient beings in the wild and in our farms. And that leads into a lot of the work we'll talk about later, about, you know, why animal agriculture, for example, is a weird taboo that must not be mentioned in many environmental movements. So that's my frustration, that's my worry, is let's just not forget the sentient beings. I should stop rambling on now, but I don't know if you have any reflections on those risks about going further.
I think we can also use it as an opportunity to build bridges with the environmental movement by having this generous, as you said, perspective. Because it's, I think it's something that I deeply believe, and I think we probably, in some way, probably agree on this, that, you know, that if you went to an old growth forest and you saw these trees, that you'd take several people to hug.
they're just amazing.
Just imagine, you got, I hope you, you know, unfortunately in the UK, you know, a lot of your old growth forests are gone, but in Canada,
yeah, we did our deforestation really early.
Yeah. And it's such a tragedy. And, so we have old growth forests, a lot, you know, British Columbia, a lot of them in British Columbia that are, you know, rainforests, and mid-coastal rainforests. And, so a lot of the people in that movement were, like back then in the '90s, were vegetarian. So for example, there was a peace camp at Clackwood Sound, and it was vegetarian, eco-feminist, with the exception of sometimes First Nations people would bring fish, but I, at that time I was vegetarian. So there already is that overlap, I think, with those communities, and how do we push that further? So I think there are risks, but there are also opportunities. I know what you're saying. You're saying with sentience that deserves some special consideration, and I think you're absolutely right. Like, how do we work with that? But at the same time, forests and old growth forests, they deserve special consideration, different type of special consideration. Yes.
Yeah. Thank you. That makes sense. I don't know if you had anything else to add on to that, Nicola, before we move on.
Not really, but I feel like we are all quite aligned, really, on this, and I just think because everything is connected.
Yeah.
I do think that we should give the special consideration to sentient animals, but I feel like we have to protect everything because we're all interconnected. And, you know, when we're talking about trees and forests, those are the homes of the sentient animals that we're trying to protect. So that's why I just feel like we should, you know, extend to everyone and everything.
Yeah, completely agree. If you only care about the experience and lives of sentient beings, you have to have a rich concern for the environment we all depend on and we all enjoy aesthetically. I mean, they just come together, right? So, yeah, thank you. Well, let's come on to the final crazily big question, which is how do we make a better future? And both of you have had amazing lives in various forms of seriously committed activism. So this is a big topic and we can go absolutely everywhere or anywhere. We can talk about sort of utopian visions of a hopeful future or maybe dystopian risks of where humanity might go to. We can talk about, you know, your overall theories of change, given everything you've learned. And it would be fascinating to understand how the work of Animal Save and Climate Save and obviously the plant-based treaty feed into that work. So I'm going to leave the sort of floor open to you to answer that big question of how do we make a better future in any way you like. I don't know if, Nicola, you want to kick off with a view.
I mean, obviously, I think we all want the utopian world, don't we? You know, built on mutual respect, appreciation, compassion. And you can imagine this world, can't you? A plant-based, vegan, veganic world, and without war, without exploitation for anyone. Obviously, that's what we want. And that's like way down the road over there. And then when you think about where we are now, it can be a bit overwhelming. Like, how can we possibly achieve that? It can feel like an uphill battle, and you know, you don't know if you can do it. But I always just think, try and think, kind of rein it in, and just think, well, what can I do today to work towards that goal? And if I do something every day, and Anita does something every day, and you do something every day, and we all just keep working towards that goal, that's the only way we're going to get there. And we have to go through barriers and hurdles, and we have to go up against the resistance. And but I just think we have to focus on that vision and that goal and think about how to get there. And you know, that for me is like why, you know, I'm dedicating my time to Plant-Based Treaty, because I see that as a roadmap to get partway there, that to get the vegan world. And I feel like it has the potential to shift the planet to a plant-based food system this decade, even if we all get behind it. You know, and I feel like if we do want that bright future that I'm sure we all want, it's something that we have to do now, because the path we're on at the moment is leading us towards sort of a climate apocalypse and that dystopian future. It's very, very frightening. So yeah, I feel like, I guess we're at a crossroads, and we have to make the decision now. Are we going to go towards that bright future, or are we just going to carry on the path? And I think that's why everyone, you know, has got to get behind this fight for plant-based food system. And also, but not just that, also cutting the fossil fuels. I think both fossil fuels and animal agriculture have to be tackled in equal measure to avoid planetary tipping points, which will just annihilate the planet, basically.
Yeah. And one of the things that's been fascinating as I've done this series of interviews is that many people share that sort of utopian vision, and it can almost sound naive in its simplicity, but at the same time, it's not technically hard to achieve. I mean, that's the thing I find deeply bizarre through all of these conversations. It's like, it literally is there for our taking. It's not like we need to dream up some technology that doesn't exist, or solve some intractable problem, or we need, you know, our IQs to be boosted to 300 before we can solve these things. It seems to be a question of, you know, the blockers seem to be purely about human psychology, sociology, and political will, which on the one hand is deeply frustrating, but also gives me some real hope, because we do actually have the solutions staring us in the face. I don't know if, Anita, you want to chip in with some of the big picture stuff, and then we can and drill in a little bit into Plant-Based Treaty and how, you know, how you're going to try and pull some of those levers.
Yeah, I think it's we share this frustration, but I think it's a question of values, like and worldviews. For us, it's so easy because we see the solutions because we hold these worldviews that it's so obvious. And it's like, think of a point when you didn't hold that worldview. Then you wouldn't have even thought about these issues, or like it wouldn't even been on your radar. So we take the time to learn about the climate crisis. And the more time you spend, the more serious you realize the crisis is. And you also see that other planetary boundaries are being pushed. And a lot of it has to do with simply how we treat other animals. It's that simple. And the environment. Just coming back to Leo Tolstoy and, you know, the idea that love thy neighbor and the golden rule are the most important principles, along with turn the other cheek, sort of nonviolence. So for him, like that was the worldview that he really wanted out there. And he was an ethical vegetarian, and he even knew that veganism was the right thing. It just wasn't his priority at the time. Somebody wrote him a letter and said, well, why aren't you, there wasn't a word vegan. Well, you know, why are you still, you know, wearing leather or things like that? He goes, oh, well, my priority right now is peace. So it's not on, you know, wasn't on his radar yet. So he sort of got that big picture. And when I was in peace and conflict studies at the University of Toronto, my professor was Anatole Rapoport. He was a pianist as well. He was from Russia. came to Toronto, and he won these two tournaments. And I think we had spoken earlier, Jamie. There was an iterated prisoner dilemma where you can either cooperate or defect. And you get a lot of points if you defect and the other person cooperates. If you both cooperate, you know, you get an intermediate level of points. If you cooperate and they defect, you lose out. And so there's an iterated game and you have to come up with decision rules. And so there was this global tournament of all these bright people. And he was the only one that submitted start with cooperation and then tit for tat. Basically, that is love thy neighbor and golden rule. Like it's combined, that decision rule combined those two things. And he won the tournament. And then they did another tournament thinking, okay, then everybody knew that he won. And they said, okay, how do I outsmart this? Maybe punish the other person twice when they defect once on you. And they came up with all these decision rules. And he was the only one that submitted the same one. And he won again. And it's all laid out in a book by Robert Axelrod in The Evolution of Cooperation. And in that book, he shows that this same principle applied like in World War One, you know, during Christmas when the Germans and the French and the British, like they wanted a truce. And this, and then it applies in, you know, conservation biology and, you know, the symbiotic relationships between, isn't it incredible that mathematics mirrors ethics, like our ethics that we're talking about? So that's what I'm getting down to. Like I'm saying, I believe that the golden rule, love thy neighbor, they're universal principles. Like if there's life on it, if they're extraterrestrials, if they don't adhere by those principles, they're going to self-destruct. And that's what Carl Sagan said. Like, okay, like the way we're going, he, back then, the concern was nuclear winter. You know what I mean? That's not our concern right now. But he thought if there was a global nuclear war, all those clouds would lead to, you know, would lead to a nuclear winter and we would die, you know, and we would all die. Life would extinguish on this planet. But now we're faced with, a runaway climate change effect. And it comes down to how we treat other animals as well as fossil fuels. Like, it's like, it's incredible that that's what it comes down to. And Leo Tolstoy wrote this incredible short story called King of Issarnum and King of Assyria, basically. In the short story, there's a king that dreams about how he's going to torture the other king that he captured in a war. And then a sage comes to him, pours some water over him, and then he becomes the other king. And then he realizes, oh my God, you know, what am I doing? And then in another dream, he is a cow that's being shot by a horrible biped, an arrow's being shot at him and her. At this point, the king is a female cow and the little calf. And then he realizes, oh my, you know, hunting is wrong. And then at the end of the story, he says this king decides to travel and, you know, and just preach the story that all life is one. And when you wish to harm others, you really do evil to yourself. And it's a very Buddhist sort of tale. But anyways, that was very much his, this is how do we, so he would write all these moral tales. So to answer, what is the big picture? How do we change our basic morality? How do we really have people understand the golden rule? Like that's what it's about, and love thy neighbor. So like that is part of our project. You know, when we're doing a plant-based treaty, we don't talk a lot about that, about the values.
Yeah.
But that's important work. And not enough people are doing that work. Is like the golden rule. Like maybe we should do a bunch of posts. Like everybody, like what does the golden rule mean? And just like, and love thy neighbor. And why, like how do we teach those values?
I can't agree enough. And in a way, that's partly why I've been pushing this amateurish worldview project, because it seems to me that almost every, certainly the human caused problems, are either because of a failure of compassion. We just don't care. We're not extending the golden rule or even a platinum rule. We're not taking the perspective of the other. We're not valuing the perspective of the other. So there's an ethical failure, or we've just made a catastrophic error. We've got something wrong. We've understood reality wrong. We've done something terrible as a result of it. And every human caused problem I think of seems to come back to one or the other or both of those things. So the resolution at its most foundational level to me does seem to be having a worldview that is grounded in a naturalistic way of understanding reality and a compassion for all beings that are able to experience suffering so that we don't exclude any of them. But at the same time, it can feel quite, you know, deep and background, and it's not quite as compelling as, you know, all of the other specific pieces of work we need to do. But I think it is still foundational. And I get the same, you know, my mind was blown by that Robert Axelrod book when I read it as a teenager as well, because it did link together a descriptive understanding of how evolution has come to exist. And the reason it's come to exist is because it's evolutionarily adaptive, right? It's essentially helped us and other non-human animals and even plants to survive. That's how we've been able to, you know, do all the good and bad things that we've done so far. And I guess that you can look at the massive mess of complexity of human society on this planet with all of its bad and good aspects, and you look at all of its richness, and in a way, most of that is an exercise in cooperation of some sort, you know, often flawed, often broken, often with unpleasant side effects. But it does mean that when we're trying to drive big systemic deep change, that's extremely hard to do, because you can imagine all sorts of different levels, if you like, of systems and governance that are all meshed and tied together. We've got individual choices and actions. We've got, you know, local councils and cities and national states and regional groupings and the United Nations and NGOs and corporations and, you know, this enormous complex morass. So given the complexity of all of that stuff, which arguably has been built up, you know, as an attempt for us to cooperate with each other, how do you think things like the plant-based treaty can drive change? Because some people will pick a, you know, one lever to pull. They'll say, right, it's all about individual change. Others will say, we need to get this thing passed at the United Nations. Others will say, how does the plant-based treaty fit into trying to shift that morass of human governance? I don't know if either of you can sort of tell the story of how you came up with it and how you think it should work. What is it?
I can jump in there. So with the plant-based treaty, we've got two goals or two approaches. So the first is the global agreement to the Paris Accords, a plant-based treaty. It would have three kind of principles, three demands, relinquish, redirect, and restore. So this treaty would see a halt to further expansion of animal agriculture so that we can stop the current problem getting any worse. We would then see a shift to a plant-based food system, and we'd do that using different policy tools and public information campaigns to help that shift happen. And as that shift is happening, we would then be able to like restore and rewild the earth. So that's one element of plant-based treaty. The second part that we're working on is institutional change. And that means working with cities, schools, hospitals, universities, care homes, just everywhere we interact with, everywhere that serves food, to try and get them to introduce plant-based menus or plant-based defaults, if not. And, you know, part of our work does also involve like the education side. So we recognize that we need system change and individual diet change. We can't do one without the other. They sort of feed into each other as a loop. So we focus on both of those. But we do recognize that we don't have time really to do just individual change. You know, I've been vegan 20 years. I've been doing outreach. I'm converting people to veganism. But then when you look at the figures, consumption is rising globally. It's out of control. So we need a huge intervention, which is the plant-based treaty. And, you know, we do want this global agreement, but at the same time, we're like, no, let's start implementing the treaty now. Let's, you know, get these plant-based menus. Let's get cities signed up. You know, Norwich, they signed up. They're going to ensure that there's plant-based options available at city events. They're going to get more land available for community gardens. So like everyone has like a different role to play. And through the institutional change, and using plant-based defaults, we can just start everyone shifting. Maybe Anita can jump in here because she wrote this brilliant blog about what New York City and Mayor Eric Adams is doing to drive like plant-based food transition there. Like, she'd probably be best to speak on it.
One of the things that we're doing right now is called Plant-Based Treaty 1.5 Playbook. So as Nicola mentioned, when we first launched the Plant-Based Treaty, it was more like the the focus was on collecting endorsements from individuals, groups, businesses, and cities to get a global treaty. So create this bottom-up pressure for a global treaty. That was the theory of change, very much mirroring the fossil fuel non-proliferation treaty. And, you know, after Glasgow, Greta Thunberg said the results were blah, blah, blah. So what she meant by that, there was very little action at the global level. And she said, along with The Guardian, said that we need to focus on local implementation. So basically what we're doing with the second goal that Nicola mentioned is think globally, act locally. So we're focused on what can we do now at the local level. And so we're developing a playbook called Plant-Based Treaty 1.5 playbook, which looks at the best practices around the world for all these different institutions. So we're collecting them. Like, so for schools, you know, what are the best practices? You know, some schools aren't completely plant-based. Some of them have greener by default. Some of them have meatless Mondays. Some of them have plant-powered Fridays. That's where New York City comes in. So when we're looking at best practices, one of the most incredible leaders on this planet at this time is Mayor Eric Adams. And he wrote a book called Healthy at Last, sort of ringing, you know, sort of after the freedom, free at last. And he had a journey where, you know, he was he lost his eyesight. He could one morning he could barely see his he lost his feelings at the tips of his fingers, and he was sort of full blown diabetes. He had full blown diabetes type 2, and so he went to his doctor, and his doctor said, oh, basically you're going to be on insulin for the rest of your life, and you know you're not going to be able to drive and so forth. And he didn't accept it, and he Googled recovering or, you know, from it. And then he discovered Dr. Esselstein, and he went on a plant-based diet. And one of the beautiful things he did, and again, this is ethics, you know, really core ethics. He said, I am so happy that I was able to heal myself. I promise Dr. Esselstein that I will do everything in my power to have all my constituents learn about this. So it's just, I don't know what ethical principle is that. Is that the golden rule? Is that the platinum rule? I don't know what it is or something. It's a really beautiful, love thy neighbor and golden rule. I don't know. But anyways, it's a beautiful ethical principle. And he stood by it. So when he became president, when he was president of the Brooklyn Borough, he introduced Meatless Mondays. And then the mayor, de Blasio at that time, then spread it to all of New York. So then all of New York City had a million children participating in Meatless Mondays. Then when Eric Adams became mayor of New York City, he then extended it to a second day, plant-powered Fridays. And then he was also committed to lifestyle medicine, which is more progressive in the US than it is in the UK. So it's very much like plant-based food is the key principle, as well as getting your sleep and exercising and not drinking and smoking and things like that. So anyways, he then... he already had introduced it in Brooklyn when he was president of the borough, but when he became mayor, he then introduced it throughout New York City. So all he worked with the American Lifestyle Medicine Program, and they provided $44 million to offer training to every health professional on lifestyle medicine. And then he introduced greener by default, which is really vegan by default, in public hospitals. And he introduced a version where it's twice. So like if you go to one of the 11 public hospitals, you're offered a plant-based meal. If you say no, you're offered another plant-based meal. Then if you say no, you're offered, you know, an omnivore meal. And 60% uptake and high satisfaction.
Wow. Yeah.
And so right away. So like, so, you know, that's the best practice. Because if you look at, you know, some of the goals that students come up with, like we're working with different groups and they say, oh, let's have a goal of, you know, having... you know, 50% uptake of plant-based by 2030. You don't have to do that. If you go greener by default, you can get 60% now, even higher. So like, so that's why it's important to look at best practices.
Yeah.
And work with other partners. So the plant-based treaty works with other partners like greener by default. They worked with LinkedIn, implemented it at their head office. They worked with New York City on the 11 hospitals. So Humane Society So the Maine Society International is doing great work on menu change, Mercy for Animals. So there's lots of groups doing it. So that's positive because that wasn't true a few years ago. There's a lot more focus now on system change, policy change.
Yeah.
And as Nicola outlined, the plant-based treaty, what I like about the plant-based treaty is it's so broad. So the three principles she mentioned, and also on our website, you'll find the 38 detailed principles that go under each of them. And we met with Dr. Baruti. She's one of the, you know, three women that were working with the great apes, you know, along with Jane Goodall and Diane Fossey. So she works with orangutans in Indonesia. And she said, "What I love the plant-based treaty because it's a big idea and I need a big idea." So the big idea is those three R's. So yes, it's about menu change, but it's also about, you know, no new animal farms, no new slaughterhouse, and it's about rewilding.
Yeah.
So our, you know, our message here is, I don't know if you can see that, eat plants, plant trees.
Yeah.
That's our message. And do you see what I mean? So like, do you see how it combines sentience and animal rights with like the environment and rewilding, you know? So we're blessed by that.
And that's one of the things I've been, as a total amateur, I've been very impressed by, because there's a real challenge of linking the animal worlds and the environmental worlds, because you'll have, you know, maybe more purist animal advocates who only want to talk about the ethics and the sentient beings and feel like talking about human health or environmental things is a sort of distraction from the ethical horror. And I can sympathize with that, but, you know, there are other issues and we need to do what it takes. You also have the classic problem that we talked about before of the mainstream environmental movement either just neglecting agriculture as a problem set because they're so focused on energy and they're excited about electric vehicles, right? So they either forget agriculture, or actually there's a taboo there because they really don't want to have to engage with it because it might change what they have to have for lunch and what they serve at COP27. And we understand the lobbying efforts that are desperately trying to take attention away from the climate impacts of agriculture as well. So it's quite difficult to find the balance. And that's one thing I think the plant-based treaty does, is that it engages richly with the environmental argument, but it's completely unashamed about the ethical argument as well. And I think that's one of the ways, I don't know if you'd agree, that you seem to be building a much richer network of engagement of different groups than some of the other, you know, initiatives I've seen, which have sort of ended up banging their heads against one group or another. And one of the reasons why someone might worry about that is they might say, well, it's all very easy to sign up to a plant-based treaty, right, as an individual or as a council or as a city or a mayor or even a nation state. But, you know, isn't there a risk of ethics washing and greenwashing where they go, oh, we signed up, but is there really the follow through? And you've talked already about the best practices, and there's detail underneath and so on, and the things people are doing. What's your philosophy about making sure that people don't just sign the treaty up and put it on their website and, you know, actually do carry this stuff through?
Really, when a city or organization or anyone signs up, that's just like that's the first step. You've done the easy bit, you've signed up. But we do follow through and we work on the implementation. So Edinburgh, for example, they endorsed the plant-based treaty in January. But that was their first step. Their next step, which they're working on now, is they're creating a report where they're looking at the whole city and how they can apply plant-based treaty to it, how they can work it into existing projects, how they can help promote plant-based food. So they're working on this report now, and that's going to go back to a council vote later this year. And so they're really determined on the implementation. If we look at Didim, that was the first city in Turkey to endorse the plant-based treaty. Didim are now holding a vegan festival this month, and Nilgün, our campaigner there, the mayor has been introducing her to businesses, and she's been going into cafes and restaurants and training the staff on how to make plant-based dishes. And then the businesses are signing the plant-based treaty and they're adding vegan items onto the menu. So wow. She's fully working on the implementation. So we do see, you know, we do recognize that, you know, someone could just sign it and that's it, but we're fully committed to like seeing it through to the end and, you know, partnering with cities, working alongside them, giving them support so that they can implement change.
Yeah, thank you.
I just wanted to add one point to that. It certainly was a fear of ours that, you know, that some jurisdictions might just make the pledge but not want to do more. But what was surprising and what was wonderfully surprising to us is that a lot of politicians, they don't want to waste their time. And in fact, some politicians, when we first presented the plant-based treaty, when it wasn't a 1.5 version, you know, involving local implementation, it was just like a sort of support and or endorsement for a global treaty. A lot of them said, "Oh, it's a waste of time. Like, we don't have time for this." Including New York City. Like, I remember when we early approached them, they go, "Like, we're already doing things. Why would we do a pledge?" So that back then, we didn't have this well-developed sort of plant-based treaty 1.5 playbook. And so a lot of politicians, like, there's traction on this issue because they recognize the seriousness of the climate crisis. And they're already making plans for, like, sea level rise, like, you know, where Nicola yeah. lives. Like, they're already saying, "Oh, well, maybe we should destroy the cliff," you know, as the, you know, so there's already plans, you know, for cities on the coastlines. So politicians, you know, they have a limited time and they want to engage in something that's meaningful and they want to make a difference. So we've actually found the opposite problem. Like, they you know, the experience with Edinburgh has been absolutely amazing. And Didim, I think those are those are the two highlights out of the 21 cities that have endorsed so far. But Norwich, you know, they watered down a resolution, but they still are taking some steps forward. Haywards Heath was wonderful. They were the first in the UK to endorse a town that's, you know, conservative led yeah. council. But, you know, there's a green councillor that sort of championed it. And so, yeah, it's been a great experience. And we have a method to this. And what we did in the UK is, like, we had gathered all the councillor names and emails, and 20,000, and then targeted party by party, Green Party, then Labour, and then moving from there, like, individual emails. When councillors got these letters, these email letters from our newsletter, from our website, they would sometimes respond, and then Nicola would then engage with them in a much more detailed way. So yeah, we have that method. Now we're doing that now in the Netherlands. So we got all the emails of all the councillors right away, 20, 25 councillors endorsed. We're doing that now in Canada. We're going to do it state by state in the US. So it's just like, how do we engage in local politics? How do we engage with councillors? And often cities are more responsive to their constituents. There's more representation, and they also have a lot of jurisdiction over, you know, the carbon footprint. I mean, so it's really important to engage at that level. But, you know, once we have that support, then we'll engage at the state or province or county level, and then the national level, the global level. But you can see how important this is. And historically, it's happened, you know, with the Ozone Protection Agreement, the Montreal Protocol. 10 years before it was signed in 1987, when it was signed in 1987, in the 70s, the state of Oregon passed a ban on aerosols. So, like, you know, it just starts at the bottom, you know, all these jurisdictions doing things. Then the national government, you know, engages in serious global negotiations. And that's our approach, is sort of this bottom-up pressure campaign. But at the same time, it's both bottom-up and recognizing the importance of top-down. So, you know, sometimes going straight to the executive chef at a university or at an airline or at a, you know, a train company. So it's like, it's a lot of it is bottom up, very democratic. It's the best, you know, it's not a great system, but it's the best thing we have, you know, as Churchill said, you know, democracy is really important. But at the same time, you do some top down. So you do mainly bottom up, but some top down, also because we don't have a lot of time.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. And it does seem like cities are a particularly interesting sweet spot in that sort of global governance. There's, you know, individuals and a sort of scale and a sort of concentration that is willing to be a bit more on the forefront of driving progressive change. And that's one of the things I love about the plant-based treaties, because it's something you can apply at every level of governance. You can sign up as an individual, but then you as an individual can think about where up the chain can I influence, all the way up through cities and institutions and hospitals and all the way up to the UN as well. And that sort of bottom up, top down. And from your experience, it sounds like there's different ways we could take this conversation, right? One, there is a sense of sort of dread and fear and horror about the direction humanity is taking. But it feels like you've got a great deal of hope about the plant-based treaty and our potential to shift things on to a better track. How does it leave you feeling overall? Do you get, you know, what do you think the risk is that it might just fizzle out, or that when national states start to get involved, the lobbying will kick in and it will push back? And Nicola, I know you've experienced firsthand what it's like to have a state try and resist productive change. Or do you get this sense that there can be critical mass tipping points where enough cities and enough councils link up and some nations start to turn and they're using each other's best practices and it just accelerates. What's your sense? How optimistic do you feel about which way this might go?
Although often I lie in bed at night worrying about what's going to happen to us. I'm sure we all do. So there is that dread there. But also I do actually feel hopeful because we are starting to see the change. You know, just when we first started Plant-Based Treaty, we were meeting with different groups and individuals to tell them about this campaign. And so many people said to us, oh, you'll never get a city to sign up. You'll never, you know, people kind of thought we were a bit like optimistic, but we were like, no, we can do it. And we are doing it. You know, we've got the 21 cities signing up and some of those are starting to work on the implementation. So the change is happening. And I know it's much difficult at the national level, but we are sort of seeing some changes. Like I know in Ireland, they're talking about reducing the numbers of farmed animals and that's being led nationally. I think the same is happening in the Netherlands. So we are starting to see these little signs and I'm seeing positive moves in the right direction. And I think if we just keep going with it, I feel there might be tipping points because as like, say in the UK, as dairy consumption is dropping, the dairy industry, many of those farms are kind of on the verge of collapse. They are in kind of crisis. And it's going to get to a point where it's going to be very hard for the government to justify continuing to subsidize that industry when people are not even consuming the product. So I think at some point there has to be this shift and they'll have to redirect support towards the plant-based foods. Especially I feel like as we get closer and closer to that 1.5 degree warming, which is looming over us, I think there is going to be kind of maybe a critical mass or there's going to be much more pressure for them to act. We absolutely are going to have to deal with lobbyists and the industry. Like we already are experiencing lobbying groups contacting the councils that have endorsed, you know, to try and lobby against plant-based foods. It's already happening. But if we all just get behind it, we all reach out individually to our councillors and work within our communities. I just feel we can overcome it.
Yeah, thank you. How about you, Anita?
I completely agree with Nicola on that, but I just think this is a critical decade, and being naturalists, you know, we can value you know the time, the little limited time that we have to make changes now that benefit the near term future, I worry a bit because it's like the calm before the storm, and it's like we've seen a lot but we haven't seen anything yet kind of thing.
Yeah.
And what happens when there's a lot of societal breakdown? Like because we're in the business of educating people, like with the plant-based treaty, like let's have some climate literacy, let's learn about the climate crisis because people don't. Like, I don't think they realize how bad it is, but it's beginning to dawn on people because, you know, the impacts are being felt widely.
Yeah.
So that's one challenge is, and then getting them on board on the lovely idea of like, just like, let's look at best practices. Let's elevate some of the leaders here, like Eric Adams or Edinburgh and all, like, you know, there's real leadership here. Let's elevate them. Let's learn from them. Let's innovate. Let's do these things. But you know, I do feel it's the calm before the storm, and we really need to take advantage of this decade because we don't want to be in a situation where there are hundreds of millions, potentially billions of refugees, and there's complete societal breakdown, and you know, there's right-wing extremist politics, there's fascism, you know, we don't want to go there. So you know, we got to make the most of this decade. So I appeal to all your listeners, I appeal to everyone. Is put your time and resources into solutions now. If you want to make a good investment, like all businesses, everyone should be like investing in solutions now because we don't want to go, you know, we can create paradise on this planet or just, you know, we can have the re-enchantment of the world. You know, one of my favorite books by Berman, I don't know if you know that book, but a beautiful book called The Re-enchantment of the World. But we have this, we're at a crossroads. We either go down this road, paradise, or we go to runaway climate change. I really feel You know, do we really want a world where, you know, most of the species become extinct? Like, it just seems it's hard to appreciate the level of that crime.
Yeah.
You know, the crime against nature. It's just hard to, we don't want to be this horrible species.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, I just think, like, my message is like, we have a decade, like, let's do something with this decade.
Yeah. And the clock is ticking.
Yeah. Like Nicholas said, we can, the solution's there. We have the roadmap. We have the fossil fuel non-proliferation treaty. We have the plant-based treaty. You know, together, I think we have the roadmap to address this crisis. But by addressing the climate crisis, we're also addressing those other planetary boundaries with the solutions, you know, like the water, the biodiversity crisis. You know, there's a number of planetary boundaries, the nitrogen crisis, and on and on.
Yeah. So the threat is real. And some people follow that into a sort of nihilistic doom. And you two just aren't there, right? Because it's not technically that hard to fix, right? We just need to choose to do it. The solutions are there. Leaders are stepping up already. Institutions are changing. You've got the playbook. You know, we just need to decide to do it. So let's get on with it. Yeah. Well, thank you. It's been fascinating to talk to you both and inspiring. I love what you're doing with the plant-based treaty. In so many ways. And what's the best way of people, over and above what you've said so far, practically supporting your work, following what you two do individually, signing up to the plant-based treaty themselves, getting involved in the campaigning? Where would you point people?
So if you visit plantbasedtreaty.org, from the website, you can endorse the plant-based treaty as an individual, business, group, or city. And when you endorse, you can join our newsletter, and that means you're going to get email actions sent to your inbox with all the different things you can do. And then the other thing you can do on our website as well is you can register for an introductory call so that you can meet the team, you can learn more about the campaign, and learn about how you can get involved, either joining a team or starting a team. So if you go to plantbasedtreaty.org/start, there's a little form there, and that would allow you to register for that call. And then in addition, we're on all the social media platforms like Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, Facebook, LinkedIn, so you can connect with us on there and follow all our updates.
Now that's brilliant. Yeah. And do you do any social media yourself, Nicola, that you want to reference? Or
I mean, you can find me on Twitter and LinkedIn and places like that, but I feel like most of the good content is on plant-based treaty.
Yeah, thank you. How about you, Anita?
Yeah, same. I just have a Twitter handle called Animal Rights Yay.
I like it. Simple message.
But I like what you said. You know, let's get on with it. And you know, the motto for New York City Mayor is getting things done. Something like that. Let's just do it.
Yeah, we know what we need to do. Well, that's brilliant. Thank you so much for taking the time, both of you, to be on Sentientist Conversations. And it's been brilliant to interview two guests at once. It's been a great experiment. So thank you so much, and for all of your work too. Take care.
Thank you so much, Jamie. Awesome.
Thank you. Thanks. Bye.
Thanks for listening. You're helping to normalize rational, compassionate thinking. Don't forget to subscribe, leave us some stars or a review. You can visit sentientism.info to find out more, and you'd be very welcome in any of our online community groups. The biggest is on Facebook. If you like what we're doing, why not tell your friends about us?